Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmed and Dwight on Eagle FM. As usual, we're here, your drive time show. That's from 4:30 to 6. It's a Thursday, right?
Yeah, it's Thursday. Yeah. You're the second person asking me that because it feels like a mini Friday. It's not a Friday. It's not even mini in any regards.
No, for some reason it started feeling like Friday yesterday for me.
Look, today has Friday vibes, primarily because it's obviously, Good Friday tomorrow. But it doesn't mean that we stop working here at Eagle FM, primarily because we have to bring the conversations to our listeners.
Yep, as always.
Specifically during this drive time period, here on this lovely Thursday. So wherever you're listening to us from, guys, you have to tune in, and this is an interesting conversation we're obviously going to have, because it does take a governance perspective very quickly.
Yeah, it does.
And it obviously also has particular roots in terms of, not just nature conservation, but overall resource management.
Environmental protection.
Yeah, environmental protection.
So it's basically like balancing natural resources extraction from the environment in a way that also considers, environmental protection.
Exactly.
And it does take us to the Mines and Tourism Ministry discussion we had.
Yeah.
About,
what
if we found the resources in an UNESCO World Heritage area?
Where
rare species of animals or plants are found. But the thing is, there's oil under, so.
Or there's.
Halfway through the document, it started going, well,
it doesn't sound like it's trying to protect anything. It's more like trying to say.
Drill baby.
We have to get there by any means necessary. So, yeah, I mean, if we were worried about Donald Trump on his side, championing fossil fuel usage,
yeah,
that policy document should have told anyone last year, it's, guys, you might go and see elephants on the right while mining is taking place on the left.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say then that there's like a little Donald Trump in all of us.
Yeah, there is.
When it comes to resources, oh, no. I think that's a part, that's sort of like lays the foundation of today's discussion. The extractive industry, just all across the board, it has a very high return on investment. Mm. And the oil and gas, industry by far seems to be, topping the chart in terms of return on investment in the overall extractive industry.
Yeah.
Now, that means, if you look at Namibia's oil and gas industry, with the production projections being put somewhere between mid-2030s, it doesn't look like it's a very long time between now and 2033, 2034, 35. But, if you are one of the industry experts, having to put together all the needed infrastructure, to go through the surveys and all the needed infrastructure to commence with the production phase, and if you are the lawmakers that wants to make sure that, we don't end up with a Dutch case disease, that means you want to have, all the right legislations in place for all the, accountability measures and transparency and all that to make sure that, Namibia basically, first of all, everyone benefits, that's one. Two, you don't want to sink the country into a resource chaos. You want to govern these resources in a sense, in a way that Namibia joins the success story of natural resource countries, not the Dutch.
Good.
Now, to pull that off, when you think of it that way, you begin to see that the time between now and 2030 is not a very wide gap, considering how sluggish we are when it comes to formulating policies.
I mean, we've already begun on certain things, Helmut. For the past 2 weeks, we've seen that we've got a lot of... I almost said bills. But we've got a lot of potential legislation in pipelines. Once again, just sitting somewhere. Even when we did the discussion our talk yesterday of the NIPS, the Namibia Intellectual Property Policy and Strategy for, the 2.0 that had the version 2 or number 2 that had to be, developed. The consultants that were hired, which was the Kenyan guy with the three Namibian consultants, when they were hired, they had to look at what's already in Namibia, what has already happened, and potentially what recommendations can they lay forward. One of the recommendations, Helmut, was a scenario of that there is so much pipeline. Okay, that just sounds weird. That there's so many drafts of good, potentially good, legislation stuck in pipelines all across the executive, all across the ministries. Some ministries obviously don't exist anymore, like industrialization and trade, because BIPA actually fell under industrialization and trade. Now BIPA has to find itself, has to discover whether or not they're under, industries, mines and energy, or if they're under international relations and trade. Now, when you look at realms like this, and you go talk to any ministerial official of international relations and trade, remember, that literally means that ministry, a whole contingent of the old ministry of MIT, went to the mine sector. And the other half has to go to international relations sector side. That means when you go and look, when you have conversations like the interesting side conversation I had with one of the PROs of international relations, because I asked them, how are you guys handling this new adjustment of the trade component in your name? And the lady told me, you know, Dwight, it's actually a good thing you're mentioning that, because we are trying to understand how, because there's a set way of international relations that countries do between each other.
Yeah.
However, Helmut, if you go switch on CNN or BBC, you hear the president, sorry for that little bit of distortion. You hear the president of the United States talking business. You hear the prime minister of the UK talking business.
Although the current president of the United States is talking more about looting than business, but.
That too. But even the previous president, Joe Biden, he spoke business. He, when they have a press conference, when he meets with another international leader.
Dude, he was in Angola.
Exactly. They talk business. And he came to Angola for a business, project. Now, if our leaders go somewhere, we have to talk about the politics of things, but not what does the politics lead to. Hence the reason why I always said before the changes that were made back in last year, meaning 2024, when we here on the home run, you know, you can't have international relations without trade. Yeah. So firstly, first step, we did a good thing, you know, splitting up.
Combining.
Yeah. But then it makes things weird for entities. If you look at the SOEs like BIPA, SOEs like, who's the other one? SOEs like NCRST. Because NCRST generates intellectual property. Okay. Not them directly, the universities that fall under their scope. Nah. But the universities are also SOEs, and the universities fall under the Ministry of Education directly. Yeah. And then BIPA just goes for the registration of things and the having protections. And then the other conclusion that we reached yesterday was that if you ever have to go and look at commercial disputes regarding intellectual property or copyright infringements and protections and things of a similar nature, it's not the SOEs stepping in to defend the aggrieved party. The aggrieved party has to launch a legal challenge against the perpetrating party, so that, you know, to seek, obviously, you know, compensation.
They're more often civil cases.
Exactly. No, most of the time they're civil cases. So the discussion here was, do we see things of such a nature in Namibia? Very few. Because one of the suggestions that was given in those consultants' discussion yesterday was, you must strengthen something, and how do you enact enforcement? But then a lovely article that I read in one of the other media publications popped up with an artist that does not like the $2 Namibian royalty for every time his song is played. I went like, what? What? Is that how low we value our own people? Who negotiated that number? Helmut? That means, firstly, whoever decided on that quantity needs to be taken to a court.
Wait, 2 Namibian dollars as when it's played once.
Once.
Okay.
So, yeah, it would sound, if your song is probably famous, ne?
Yeah.
And your song.
That means the more it's played, the more $2 you make.
Yeah. But if your song is like, if you have like one of the radio DJs are just likes your music and no one else likes your music, then you're just stuck with that $2.
Nice to know. I've been giving about, you know, a couple of local artists, a couple of $2.
Yeah.
My Sunday show. But, yeah. Now, look, the whole, hang on a second. Now, I really like the theme that this, oil and gas / eco discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the theme was, oil and gas. That's not the theme, by the way. That's just someone's putting everything together. A panel discussion. Oil oversight and accountability. The governance challenge. That's the theme.
Mm.
Yeah. So I just lumped it in the reference, starting with the panel discussion. But that was actually, you know, the panel discussion was themed oil oversight and accountability.
Yeah.
The governance challenge. So oversight and accountability speaks to overall transparency. For you to hold people accountable, you must have the process that's so transparent, because that's transparent, because that's the only way you'll be able to see what's going wrong.
Yeah.
And then hold the whoever is the perpetrator accountable. If you don't have transparency, then that means it will be very hard for you to pinpoint what is going wrong and who is doing it and how to hold them accountable.
For example, remember the first speaker after the introductory speech when we started when that eco dialogue panel discussion began. So, dear listeners, one of the interesting things was actually that they began on the amendment to the Petroleum Act.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad two of the ladies on that panel were lawyers, or they were people with legal backgrounds and practicing backgrounds.
Yeah, is it Stephanie Bush, energy law specialist?
Yeah.
Like, okay, that sounds awesome.
And when she highlighted specifically that this director general position that would be positioned in the presidency, and the petroleum commissioner would be taken out of the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Energy, I missed that because I sat through the draft. Remember, we sat through the draft, and I missed that. I was like, How
is this going to work?
But I obviously looked at the other particular powers that would be given to the office of the presidency, for example, taking anything, changing everything in the act, speaking towards where you've got the minister being mentioned. Now it's being the president. So Bush highlighted a very interesting thing. So an oversight committee, like we've now been enjoying the reports from the oversight committees of National Assembly.
Yeah.
And if there's something goes wrong, who does that oversight committee pull to come and please explain to them about why certain things are happening? Do they now, they can't call the director general. They can't call, who was the other person? They can't call the minister anymore. Do they now tell the president, please come sit here.
Yeah, panel discussion.
Come and explain to us.
Yeah.
Why XYZ decisions were made. Which makes things tricky, Helmut. And I'm so glad, you know, I sometimes like it how you can have multiple views on the same thing that showcase certain areas. We spoke about that petroleum amendment bill and we highlighted, okay, so these are the obvious things that you see. Then she highlighted, okay, in the event of an oversight event, what happens?
You know, one thing, now that you point that out, you know, one of the biggest problem now I'm beginning to have with this whole, transfer of some of the, I think it's safe to say, some of the mandates that should be under the Ministry of Mines, Mines and Energy to the executive branch. Mm. The problem that creates is my problem with more often discussions that are coming out of the executive branch goes political really fast.
Yeah.
That's one problem. Picture the, you know, the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Constitutional Legal Affairs, with the famous / infamous Oshakati courtroom door. Mm. They had to sit with the, you know, they had to sit basically across the table from the, you know, representatives of the judiciary.
Mm.
So that, so you have, the standing committee representatives on one side, the representatives of the judiciary on one side, and they basically had to answer questions over why it was taking over 5 months to replace a door. Now, when the institution you are dealing with is now under the executive branch, do you then take the president out of running a country, literally, to come and answer questions about what's going on? That's unnecessarily burdening yourself.
Yeah, it is. It literally is. Now, the question obviously means, Hamoud, it's not a minister that has been given new powers.
Yeah.
It's literally, it's now someone elevated above the level of a minister. So, this obviously, you could potentially view this. Is this something that happened in reaction to the move and the shift?
What led to?
Yeah. Was it in response to afterwards when the former minister of Industries, Mines and Energy was removed and the current minister, Amutse, was installed? You know, was it because of what happened there? And then probably, because we see Mr. Bill happening this year.
Yeah.
It was submitted this year.
Yeah.
Or the particular motivation by Minister Amutse and the bill submission was supplied this year. So was it in response to what potentially happened with the first minister?
Mm-hmm.
And then the reaction is, okay, let's amend
let's
things.
Just amend
let's
thing
take powers. Yeah. The only way to take powers away from a minister is if you have the legal changes taking place.
Yeah.
And what does it look like? So, we obviously never heard what was the real motivation. Was it in response of that, or was it literally the 21 March speech that the president gave in her inauguration, where she literally said, decisions will be shared and be made through the office of the presidency regarding oil and gas?
Now, even if that statement with regards to what transpired at the Ministry of Mines with the, you know, the change in ministers, if that was true, would be having one or two mandates from the Ministry of Agriculture being run by the president, because there was also a ministerial switch there because of very dramatic circumstances.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think even if that's the reason they had, which we are not saying it's the reason they did that. It's just saying they didn't really explain why.
Mm.
Yeah. Which again raises even more questions. And now you have to understand we are, 9-10 years to production.
Mm.
And the questions are already this much. Now we have two questions popping up here. Which again, I think doesn't help my fear of things going political really fast.
That's, very good,
political really fast. And that's, if you look at it, when it comes to transparency, who are the, take for example, the shareholders of of this institution. If this institution was to do something wrong, who do we hold accountable?
Mm.
I know that institutions are held accountable because they are viewed as, entities or persons on themselves, but now there are always circumstances that arise when the individuals behind running an institution have to be held accountable.
Mm.
And, that's something that was pointed out. I think it was that in 2018, 2019 with the, Africa Personnel Services and the government of the Republic of of Namibia case.
Mm.
The court pointed out that, yes, institutions, organizations are registered as separate entities, but the law is fully aware that behind this organization are people like you and me that are running this institution. Yeah. What, you know, they're the main beneficiaries of the day-to-day operations and revenue generation of this institution. So whenever something goes wrong, and it's too, like, it's too, sort of like accountability is needed ASAP.
Mm.
You have to hold, well, the guy behind the executive, office, the executive office or managerial office accountable.
Mm.
Now, if you are not revealing who are the main beneficiaries, it becomes a little bit difficult for you to determine, like, who should be held accountable.
Yeah.
And obviously everyone that understands the basic, like, structure of every institution knows, especially in commercial, like, you know, in the commercial enterprises, is you have shareholders and you have your board of directors, you have your executives, aka your CEO, your CFO, your COO, and you have your managers and you have the minions.
Mm. Don't call them minions, Amut. Don't call them.
Of course, when you're talking about accountability,
yeah,
you are more often talking about, accountability is coming out of something going wrong.
Mm.
Yeah. This is something that went wrong here. We have to hold someone accountable. And this is more often someone that has the authority to make decisions that led to something going wrong.
Yeah.
90% of the chances that's not going to be Helmut. Now, that means, who are the, beneficial ownership? Let's get there. But from the look of things, that's also somewhat a little opaque.
It is.
Yeah. And then you have this whole shift of, mandates from, if you ask me, something that should be under a ministry to the executive branch. Now, it doesn't matter where you do that, not just in Namibia. Every time you basically make changes without explanation, questions are bound to come. And in a political sphere, that starts political point scoring.
And, I mean, Hamoud, okay, with the beneficial ownership thing, it also highlights a very interesting, and it's actually a good thing you pointed this out before we started with the show, where the IPPR's Graham Hopwood kept mentioning, because I shared the audio with Helmut so that he knows I always record things fully about what was said at events from start to finish. And I only realize now that Hopwood keeps mentioning that if there was a time when they do research, the IPPR, they would request, who are the owners of businesses, ventures, entities interacting with Namibia's natural resources who are trying to, extract the natural resource or participate in shipping it and stuff like that. And there was a time apparently that you could request documents or, information, no, not documents, information about companies and entities from BIPA, and then he cites, then BIPA just goes and just went and stopped it without motivating why they stopped it.
Again, you have another change without a motivation. That's not good precedence.
It's not good precedence, Hamid, but it's also a bit of a weird thing because primarily, if you go in the register, like our conversation yesterday of intellectual property, copyright and all that, and specifically the last part of our conversation yesterday, we were talking about things like company names, similar sounding company names, similar font being used in the name itself and on letterheads and on official communication.
Logos, pictures.
Logos, all those particular things. Those are supposed to be things that if you go and register a company name you've got in your mind, that should be something that you can access through, okay, could you check whether someone has registered the company name I have in my name so that I can know I might have to come up with a second option. That is public information. That should be public information. That should be something that you see immediately right there. I mean, if you get suggestions for a profile name from Facebook or from Instagram, just like that, and they tell you, this is what is left. This is what is left, meaning somebody else has it. What's wrong with an entity like BIPA not, disclosing, if you request information about something and not being too able to assist? Now, obviously, The information is obviously the context. What kind of information?
Yeah.
Now, we already have the Access to Information Act. However, we don't have the Information Commissioner. So you can see primarily that up until now, entities can say, nah, we don't want to supply, and we don't have to motivate why we're not supplying you with the information that you requested, because we just don't feel like it. Probably because they also know that there won't be any enforcement. The Access to Information Act, how it works like this. You first have to go and request the information. So you first go to BIPA.
Yeah.
Let's say you've got an investigation or a bit of research. You go and request information from BIPA. BIPA says, no, Helmut, I won't help you with your request. Because you got that rejection, and they should motivate why it stands when they act and
yeah.
in the Access to Information Act. They have to motivate why they say no. You take that motivation and you can go and report them to the Act, the Information Commissioner. The Information Commissioner is not an SOE reporting to a ministry. Yeah, they probably would have to submit financials and budgets to Ministry of Finance.
Yeah.
But they're not subservient to any ministry. And the explanation I got when I went and viewed it, when it came into being end of 2023, leading into 2024, because the civil society guys here in Namibia, they brought in a legal expert who is a lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, WITS. And that professor explained, or that lecturer, she explained, primarily that how the process would have to flow is that you then go lay that complaint with the commissioner. The commissioner is on a level similar to an executive director in a ministry, supposedly, so that there's no undue political interference, meaning the fear that you had about things becoming political very quickly.
Yeah.
And primarily that supposedly transparent things happen. So they have to act like the ombudsman, you know, in investigating things and generating reports about,
you know,
a member of the public makes a complaint, then they go and request, you know, why did you do this?
You know, let them shoot themselves in the foot.
Which would make our job even more exciting, however, because there's another entity that will bring in some further interesting reports themselves, supposedly from a neutral basis. But yeah, we wait. So that is how the process should be.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have an act. We don't have an information commissioner yet. That still has had to be decided. I didn't check up on the because they advertised a little bit earlier in this year, technically in January, of the for the role of the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. I didn't check it because it had some ridiculous requirements there, but yeah, I was like, okay. So we know that we've got certain things going for us, but in many cases, many of these particular legal instruments that the legislative of Namibia passes, the lawmakers, and the executive just doesn't implement it. So, for example, here's another particular good governance issue that we saw happening back in last year. Suddenly, ACC starts publicly announcing how they're arresting people left, right, and center. And you're like, hey, what's going on here now? We didn't see this stuff. We did not see this stuff. What's going on here? So, yeah, fun times. Don't worry. Fun times. But with fun times, you know, you've got to ask the question, but why only now? What happened before and up till...
What happened to finding out things from Al Jazeera?
It doesn't mean that Al Jazeera has not let us go, ne? Don't give them motivation. So yeah, I mean, those are one of the governance things that we've got to look at. And then obviously there was the other talking point, because I also have to disclose, guys, that on the same Eco Dialogue panel was my brother, Frederico Links, and he highlighted there specifically the indication of understanding natural resources, that natural resources is a business. It obviously attracts business.
Yeah.
and that government has to understand that it represents the public interest as a stakeholder in business transactions. Now, the big question is, Hamoud, do we actually get value for money? Meaning, how transparent is the interactions between the government and a multinational company that would like to access a resource? And in many cases, we hear conflicting information sometimes. I am super happy of the Omaheke uranium thing wherein.
Oh, no, that's a good one.
That was poetry. Because we actually saw how somebody was chopping the money up till 2021. And then when things had to jump across the fence, you go like, okay.
On second thought, environmental problems, I see them here. Now.
Let's just.
I didn't see them from 2013, but now I do.
No, from 2011.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, you're right. From 2011.
We didn't see them from
2011. I mean, I don't know what was between me and this environmental. There was a wall here made out of Hendrik Verbois. That was this. That wall that's made out of Hendrik Verbois is one that prevented me from, you know, seeing all these environmental challenges that is most likely to be brought about by your explorations. Mm. Now that the wall of Hendrik Verbois have shifted, now I see all these problems. So please stop.
Yeah. Which also highlights a governance issue.
A big one.
A big one.
A very big one.
Because we know, okay, we've got the policy document, the most obvious one that is active right now, NDP6. And NDP6 highlights, okay, the president's famous words of, we are too few to be poor. Yeah, but for a year, Helmut, you and I have been highlighting what could be done. And are we seeing any sort of moves towards literally trying to achieve the noise you and I have been making? No, we're not engineers, guys, but we do watch YouTube and we do see what people in other countries are doing. So the question we just have to ask is, why are we too sluggish to achieve goals that actually deliver mass benefit to our fellow Namibians? What's so difficult? And then obviously, you know, we have to be thankful for an entity like Al Jazeera, you know, that knows how to embarrass Namibia. But yeah, because, I mean, if you hear things about SIM card, iPhones that supposedly can take 2 SIM cards, things start sounding truly dodgy, because then you ask your iPhone friends, it's a, does something like that exist?
You can just buy 2, right?
I know that an Android can take 2 SIM cards, but I've never heard of an iPhone. And I even thought, because I've been an Android user for all my life now. I've never heard of an iPhone user saying, my phone can take 2 SIM cards. That'll still be a golden take. Yeah. So, I mean, we're in year 2 now of the 8th administration. That's now presidential administration, obviously. So, and I know the optics, Helmut, that because at every particular engagement where there's a minister or an executive director or even the president. Okay. I know the president will always say the sentence, but they love highlighting and making mention of the Swapo Party manifesto. Highlighting the manifesto. And Robin Sherborn loves highlighting that there are actually 3 policy documents. It starts from...
You have your NDP6, one hand.
And then it's the Swapo Party manifesto. And then there was another Swapo Party...
The Swapo Party implementation plan.
Yeah. So he mentions those 3.
Yeah.
And then he assumes the audience has read them. And I, you know... There's very few of us.
Hey.
But it makes things interesting, because we also have to understand, okay, if we are trying to attract foreign investors, what's the actual picture? Is the government functionaries of the government willing to generate data that investors can see, oh, this is this and this is that and that is this, in order for them to make quicker decisions. Because Helmut, we can't wait every 11 years for a census, doch man. We can't wait 11 years for a census. And in between, we might have surpassed Vision 2030 with the, you know, explosion of population elements and household activities. Maar nog steeds. I mean, we need the data.
In 2024, it was 2024-2025, it was revealed that Namibia has over 200 unrehabilitated, abandoned mines. Again, I'm going to go back to the location of our offshore oil discoveries. They're about 300 kilometers offshore.
Exactly.
300 kilometers offshore.
6 meters down.
Yeah.
Okay, 3 to the floor. And three.
Three. Now, here's the thing. This resources is about 300 kilometers away from Namibia's mainland, from the coast to where it is. Now, I'm not going to say a lot of Namibians have never been to the coast. Leaving that out of the equation.
I'll be honest. I've never been to Lüderitz, Helmut, but I've seen I've never been to I've never been to the Kunene region as well.
I just said any coast, so you've been to the coast. Now,
no, Swakop doesn't count. Swakop and Walvis doesn't count, Helmut. Because you're talking about a pretty big piece of real estate, you know?
We have a very wonderful bioland coastline.
And I don't remember Oranjemund, so that doesn't count.
You don't remember?
I was a baby, dude. Who remembers Oranjemund if you're a baby?
It doesn't count.
Look,
the thing is, the reason why I brought up the rehabilitation, the abandoned mine now you have to understand that this is not one, it's 250.
True.
250. That speaks to some serious legislative sluggishness. I mean, this is a mine. It's not something that you can hide in your pocket. This is a very giant pit.
Mm.
A giant pit that you can just see from, you can literally see the biggest, you know, some of the big ones from space. So that means if we cannot regulate, if we cannot put environmental protection, if we cannot enforce environmental protection laws on land, it will be very difficult to assure any Namibian that comes, you know, that comes with a question about environmental protection. When the discussion you're having is about a resource that's about 300 kilometers offshore, plus our vessels that are supposed to protect our fish.
There's only two of them.
Yeah, our fish is in an orphanage somewhere, being, you know, fished out by a bunch of pirates. The point is...
Did you say orphanage?
Abandoned, you know. Abandoned by its owners.
How can fish be orphaned?
Well, we are the parents and we are nowhere to be found. So a bunch of fishermen coming from, you can imagine, maybe South Africa, Angola, you know.
The South Africans obviously would have to sail upwards.
Yeah.
Which is pretty easy because there's obviously a lot of traffic here, that southern coast of ours, because of the oil exploration guys and the diamond mining, seabed diamond mining taking place. So it's not easy for the South Africans to then, you know,
go around.
There is a channel for them to move through, but there would be a lot of eyes on them.
Yeah.
The issue is that Kunene coastline, Helmut, it's mostly Spanish and Angolan boats that they do literally hit and runs. They sail in, catch, sail out.
Like Tura boys, but at sea.
Yeah.
Now,
as a forfeiture, but in a boat.
Y'all are grabbing iPhones and people are grabbing fish. Grow up, people. Now, look, the thing is, you're not only talking about transparency in terms of who owns what and who is benefiting from what. That's, you know, of course, those things are going to come up. But then again, my biggest problem, and this is, now, this is basically what the Office of the President have been, trying to clarify, because it's been all over the media about, the President's relatives' alleged interest in the oil and gas industry. Now, with allegations like that, and you move that industry into your office, you're not helping.
No, you're not. That's literally putting the bee right next to the nectar of the flower that the honey is to be made from.
Yeah.
Look, Helmut, there's clearly nothing wrong for relatives of the president to work in the mining sector.
Yeah.
Because it would have been a known fact also before the president became president.
You know, that's something that, that was my perspective on the subject. I'm like, if I find out, for example, that the president's son or daughter works for the oil and gas industry, the question I just, ask myself is he qualified to have the job? If he's qualified to have the job, well, I don't care, because that son is not the president.
Mm.
Yeah.
Or if they
and work, like any Namibian, if from my point of view, like any Namibian, they can participate in any industry. You can't just be homeless. I mean, you can't just be, unemployed because you are related to the president and the minister. That doesn't make sense.
Exactly. Which is also a scenario, for example, like the two presidents back, where the discussion back then of the former president Buhamba and under the mass housing deal, I think it was the daughter of the president.
Yeah.
The name came up. At that stage, obviously, I was working at the media company who wrote a lot about the specific president's daughter.
Yeah.
That, all these business ventures, her name pops up here and pop up there. And I was on the same university with the individual. I was like, I never knew. And I was even told that she apparently won Miss Polytech or Miss Nast. I was like, what? Who?
No,
when?
No, look.
And there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong for her opening up a business.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong for the business tendering for business, submitting for bids. There's nothing wrong.
That's where I like, the piece of legislation that the Bank of Namibia is based on, because it explicitly explains, the governor cannot participate.
Yeah, the governor should not have a business.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you find something that's that explicit in a piece of legislation, then you find out that the governor is running, a side hustle somewhere. Now that you can criticize, because you'll be like, dude, this is the institution you work for. This is the piece of legislation it's run on, and this is what it says. Why are you doing this? But if there is no specific piece of legislation, even if something like that was done, it would be very difficult for you to say, Governor, why are you doing this? Because the question they will ask you is, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
And now this is not where you now have to start thumbsucking and start, pulling explanations from the blue. You have to point out, yes, you are wrong on this and this and this and this, according to this and this piece of legislation. Now, that's why I said, if you ask me, taking a high return on investment, highly sought after in terms of investment, a mandate that should be under the Minister of Mines in the executive branch, that's going to make, a lot of things with regards to any of those things, whether it's by investigation or reports, is going to go very, 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 very political. And most of it, if you ask me, is coming out of paranoia, because leaders in a lot of powerful positions have been known to benefit those in close proximity to them. And the biggest textbook example of this was the Angolan former president.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's
he made his son the chief of the central bank. His daughter was the chief of.
I think the daughter is the one that was running the oil. Yeah.
It was oil, and there was another company.
What was the name?
She was on
Sonangol.
Yeah, yeah, but it was that one, and there was another company that she was also the chief of.
Yeah.
So whenever
I hear people start talking about the suspicion of this one is related to the president, how did they get? Partly, I totally understand their concerns, because the picture a lot of, especially African leaders, have drawn is the one of the former Angolan president. Now, because that's what people see every time they find out that someone in powerful position has relatives spread across different industries. But there are not a lot of people now who are like you and I that just starts asking questions of, okay, they're in that position, but, are they qualified to be there? If they are, then sure, fine. But if they're in an executive position of an institution that requires, a university degree to be in that position, and they got there with a grade 7 certificate, like Rajapaksa, Sri Lanka. Like, Sri Lanka took nepotism to a whole another level.
No, I know what happened with the three brothers and two cousins and best friends that were rotating between two parties. Guys, two political No, you're right, Hamid. They took it to another level. You're right. Okay, I didn't know about the grade 7 part of things.
The grade 7 part was just an example. Look, the reason why Sri Lanka took it to the whole another level, the reason why I say that is because, there was a time when, where one guy was the president, and he had, another guy with the same surname to be, I think he was, he was vice president. And fast forward at the end of the president's term, the vice president becomes president, and the president becomes vice president. I was like, huh?
And the vice president's brothers are the minister
of housing, agriculture.
And what was the other one? What was the other position? He was the president. He was the minister of something else. And then, and the one son, the one brother's son was somewhere in the government structures as well. That, guys, is another level.
That parliament was full of the same surname, which now doesn't really make sense. But the thing is,
Sri Lanka took things to another level.
Yeah, Sri Lanka took...
Sri Lanka is something else, guys.
There's nepotism, and then there was that.
Yeah.
Now...
Then there was Sri Lanka.
Yeah, Sri Lanka is in a whole...
It's like that thing in what's that Johnny English movie, the second movie, where Rowan Atkinson's character, John English, every time when he hears about Mozambique, his eyes start
jumping. Yeah, so we have, we're in 2026. We have 9 to 10 years before production phase. That means, all the governance, basically all the legislations that will regulate once we hit production, the oil and gas industry, that will basically regulate everything from revenue generation to local content policy discussion and everything, must be in place. And the shifts that are happening right now are going to raise a lot of questions. Take, for example, even if this administration comes to, comes to an end, President Tumbo leaves office and a different president comes in.
Let's say that president that comes in is someone that believes in future fuels and in green energy. What then?
Oh, boy.
What then, Howard? Because President Nandi Ndaitwah's term ends in 2030.
Yeah.
And we all know, you and I know, apparently, and I keep asking the civil society guys, why are you guys talking about oil and gas? Because we all know the oil is only coming in 2034 at the quickest. That's the quickest estimation, guys. Who is pushing for 2030? Who's pushing to deliver oil before 2030?
Okay. 2030?
Helmut, I've told you this before. There's someone pushing from a political perspective. Mm-hmm. I will just taint it like that. Someone is pushing for oil to be pumped by 2030.
Okay, I think this is where my sarcasm now takes over. Guys, there's a huge difference between oil and gas and instant porridge. And the difference is... the difference is well drawn.
You should have said Weet-Bix, not instant, because Weet-Bix is just water.
Yeah, just
instant, add water. You still have to stir it. Weet-Bix is just water, then it soaks up.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, the industry baseline survey really draws a very wonderful approximate time frame.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at the survey, at the minimum, you're looking at 2033, 2034. That's the minimum.
The latest, probably 2040 even.
Yeah.
That's the latest even.
Yeah. You have to really, you need the infrastructure in place. And the good thing about talking about infrastructure right now is that it brings up the sad story of the increase in fuel prices because of the oil and gas infrastructure damage being done in some of the biggest oil, global oil suppliers in the Middle East.
Even though Putin is apparently smiling to the bank.
I would be.
Apparently that guy is making 760 million. Russia, not Putin. I'm sorry. Let me correct it again. Russia is apparently making 760 million US dollars a day for each shipment that they allow through?
Well, look,
not even Microsoft sees their numbers. Not even Nvidia, not even OpenAI can see those numbers per day.
This is going to draw. Okay, now you have to understand that even if this conflict comes to an end, the large part of the Middle East are going to face at least a month or two, at least to a couple of years of the Dutch disease. Because
I'd say so, yeah.
Most of their, you have to understand this, most of these countries are in the middle of a desert. So they rely on, desalination plants for their water.
Yeah.
That's the weakest
strategy that you
That's the weakest. So Iran begins targeting those. Even the soldiers that you take, that you are going to send to the region for boots on the ground, what are they going to drink?
And Iran has already targeted those infrastructure.
Yeah, okay. No,
so after you and I did that talk about what Professor Zhang has highlighted, Iran has already done most of the things. We're now literally at the phase of, is Trump going to say yes, invade? And all of them, and all the analysts, political editors, political journalists, international relations, foreign relations, journalists and editors, or international, or overall international aspects of observation in the media space, all of them say the surefire, because apparently Trump and Pete Hegseth, they want to secure the Strait of Hormuz. Now remember, there's an island in the strait.
Yeah.
The channel closest to the Iranian coast around that island is what Iran blockades.
Yeah.
The channel on this side closest to, what's the country's name? UAE or?
Yeah, I think it's close to UAE.
It's not Kuwait. No, it's Kuwait. It's either Kuwait or Oman. But Oman is also an island nation, I think. But the strait, the other part of the strait, is not in Iranian territory. Now, that island, Karg Island, the one that the Americans want to invade, is apparently the island that also has some oil infrastructure on it.
Yeah, that's where I think a large chunk of Iranian oil infrastructure is based.
Yeah, so now the Americans, the discussions that have been happening, that I've been observing for the past 2 weeks, is that the Americans are contemplating whether or not to invade there. Now, Jiang's analysis highlighted to his students, yes, guys, he was talking strategy with the students, was invading in Iran, which is mountainous, which is very difficult to get out of, because the moment you go and land in the middle of a fire, it's just, you're surrounded on all fronts. And the second scenario is, that the conversation from there then starts going to negotiating losses. Not negotiating from a position of strength, negotiating from a position of weakness.
Of losing, yeah.
And losing. Now, yesterday's last night's speech, I tried watching that speech of Donald Trump because I really couldn't make any sense. He was already in the questions and answers session and he was just giving the journalists just
garbage.
You are still going with a very conservative term, but what's that famous term that, what's her name? The lady that stood against Trump in the elections from the Democrats. What was her name? The vice president?
Hillary.
No, the vice president under Biden. Oh, what was her name?
Who's this?
What was that lady's name?
Yeah, the one who speaks like she's about to fall asleep. Yeah, I remember that one.
But who doesn't make any sense.
She doesn't.
She just says, yes, because this and because that, and it's brown, but it's not brown, it's blue. But yeah, but what is it?
Yeah, and then she laughs at that.
And then she laughs at you for what she's saying. You're like, what's this lady on? Now, Trump was doing the same thing last night. I was like, what is he saying? Because apparently, he's referencing a two-week period between this week. We don't know if it's yesterday from last night or from next week for the next two weeks into April about withdrawal. What withdrawal? And because the Iranians have already said, when Trump was making promises about, apparently they're talking to the right people in Iran, and then the Iranian military, one colonel showed up there and he was yes, Mr. Trump, you're speaking to yourself. We don't know who you're talking to on our side.
That is Kema somewhere in Asia. You're negotiating, pretending to be Iran.
So the conversation, Helmut, is one of an, of the nature that, yeah, somebody is benefiting today from oil, from oil and gas sales.
Yeah.
Namibia won't be there. Namibia won't even reach 2030, because here's the discussion. Engineering and investment decisions, whether you're the government of Namibia or whether you're the president of the United States, even the president of the United States was told, we are not going into that country where all the Venezuelans are angry at the Americans.
Yeah.
And they are still saying it today. The American oil majors are saying, we don't want to go into Venezuela because of the Helmut, here's the unfortunate thing there.
Yeah.
The lady that's now president of Venezuela,
the one that took over after
the vice president.
Yeah.
She's from the same party as Nicolas Maduro. She's from the same political party. Now, do you think you, and Trump still brags about what they did. Bruh, every time when he steps onto a podium, he brags about Venezuela. Now, how do you think it feels for the Venezuelans watching an address by Trump being broadcasted?
Okay, first of all, that's not the first time the U.S. have done that. They spent 20 years in Afghanistan and then replaced the Taliban with the Taliban.
No, no one, they didn't even brag once about what they are doing in Afghanistan. Helmut, people are doing now on, there are weird things, weird documentaries and discussions happening on YouTube specifically where, you know, these independent people can just take a camera and stuff and go on the street and interview Americans and ask them, hey, what do you think about the war in this country? Or what do you think where the American soldiers are and what they've done? The level of ignorance, I'm sorry for using that word, but it's literally ignorance. The level of ignorance that the guys, that these people highlight, that record these things, they themselves are shocked by the not nonchalant even, but the laissez-faire approach that Americans have. And then they don't watch the news, then they don't know what their politicians do or their presidents, and they don't know which country is impacted. And the moment they try to go to a country, let's say you decide to, like what happens now every time, because I see a lot of these videos on my YouTube feed of Americans going to Mexico, Americans going to Europe, Americans, it happened last year actually in Mexico when a guy showed up with his MAGA, Make America Great cap. He showed up with a cap like that. It was that ugly red cap that Trump wears.
Yeah.
He showed up with a cap like that at a tourist spot in Mexico, Helmut. At the time when he was saying he will invade Mexico.
Ish.
And then the Mexicans will not, hey, brah, this is, you're almost not culturally sensitive here. And then he got chased away from the hotel, from the establishment. Another American family apparently went to, what was the place's name? Also in Mexico. But the wife put on a Make America Great t-shirt. And the husband had an American, it was a cap with an American flag on the one side. Got chased in the street because of the views that their president has with the international world. And that was still in the climate of the, remember the tariffs and the supposed trade deficits and stuff?
When I was busy tariffing everyone.
Yeah. It was under that climate still. Now, how do you think Americans now feel with what happened to Venezuela at the start of this year? What is currently happening to Iran, obviously, you know, from last month? The climate for, and specifically this is American tourists even. The climate for them is that people obviously equate the actions of their government to very innocent everyday people who try to visit in other places. That yes, they are the embodiment of the political power or the political powers that be of their government.
Yeah.
And that's an unfortunate thing, Helmut, because now if you're hearing that their Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, made that statement that we analyzed, calling on Europe to be proud of their colonial past.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness. My goodness.
I have one better for you. Son of the Ugandan president,
the head of the army.
Said you know, the war in the Middle East must end, but if Israel loses, he will you know fight on the side of Israel.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah, saw that headline.
Yeah,
I didn't read it because I was like, this is rubbish.
You know, in the name of Jesus. Now, here's one thing. Here's one thing.
The Jews hated Jesus.
While Homeboy is using religion to justify war, the Pope is basically saying, you know, the Pope has recently been criticized for saying, you know, I think it was a religious procession that he was holding, and he said something like God is something like in the lines of God does not answer the prayers of people that basically want to wage wars. He didn't mention any names, but he rattled a lot of feathers. So you have a religious leaders that's saying, you know what, I dedicated my whole life to religion, and I can tell you this war is not a good thing. And you have an army general that's saying, actually, in the name of religion, something I only do once every Sunday at good times.
Because his sister is head of the church, ne?
Oh, I did not see that. See, now,
you forgot, but remember, that. it was where Musa Feni and his wife went to go and apologize
To the people of the
from the church.
And I thought I was the comedian. Even I never going to Uganda.
When I saw that thing on the internet, I was like, "It's a what's Museveni doing? What's Museveni doing?"
Going to apologize, you know.
I'm sorry for all the political prisoners that I locked up, and probably whose keys I threw away. How do you do things like that?
I'm still gonna be president, by the way. But the point I'm making here is,
I'm sorry
for now, and
sorry. There's a nice little Italian meme that says, I'm sorry.
Now, the point is, all the chaos going on in the Middle East that's leading to all the fuel prices, it's for the most part attributed to the damage in oil infrastructure.
Yeah.
Now, that's what will take us from 2026, 2027, all the way to 2033, 2034, to set up that infrastructure. First of all, look at how long it takes to set up the infrastructure. And then you ask, and then you look at the Middle East and understand that this is the infrastructure that's being blown to smithereens. And again, on the Kirk, is it Kirk Island, that the PS has been, you know, according to a lot of analysts have been, basically, it has reached a conclusion that that's the place they are, you know, maybe the Americans are targeting.
Yeah.
But a lot of military experts are pointing out one thing. Even if you manage to take the island, how are you planning on keeping it? Because you are within firing range.
Yeah. They will be in firing range, Hamoud. Here's the worst thing. They're on an island. What happens on an island, Hamoud? What's the biggest mistake of an island?
Have you seen Alcatraz?
It's not just Alcatraz. You know what's the biggest mistake of an island? You can literally surround it. So besides being in firing range from across the strait, ne, on mainland Iran, Iran can just put up a whole bunch of, you know, dinghies, you know, those little escape, those little lifeboats. And everybody can just have their own sort of like healthy supply of ammunition and literally surround whoever invades that island.
Like the thing is, I think every military expert, I think, you know, it really makes sense why he's a chief of counterterrorism guy resigned, because you put people in an island within firing range. You don't have to be a military expert to reach the conclusion that once you drop them there, they become sitting ducks.
Yeah. But an intelligence guy, remember, Hamoud, is not a military strategist. An intelligence guy is just there to gather intelligence and set up intelligence networks and spy and interfere when they need to. The military strategy starts happening. Okay, it's actually like Eisenhower said during the first Second World War. It's good that you prepare. It's useless in the fight. But just be prepared for the mafia. Just be prepared.
That brings up, is it, was that Hopwood's, you know, quoting Mike Tyson? Yeah. You can train, you know.
But when you get in the fight.
One punch. The whole training goes out through the window. You start improvising.
One punch. And that's literally the thing about, you know, when we look at warfare. I mean, have you heard about what was the thing's name that, not just Professor Jung said, but there was another military strategist, I think also Mearsheimer, And what was the guy's name about the when the Gaza conflict started off? You remember the guy that was the professor who's Jewish but was anti-Israeli, the military intervention? You remember that guy?
Norman Finkelstein.
They all of them highlighted at one stage in the presentations that I've seen on the internet on YouTube specifically about what happened in Vietnam. Vietnam was being sold to the American public in the 60s and 70s. Oh no, we're just helping the South Vietnamese.
Yeah, but this was before social media.
Obviously, yes. And which obviously shows how the media was used to motivate what's actually happening. Until that one major thing that happened specifically where they had to highlight where the American people through their political representatives in government, not in government, in the lawmakers, had to start asking, what's happening in Vietnam? Why are we in Vietnam? And why are people's children coming back in coffins and body bags and with all kinds of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorders and all manner of basically trauma once again, back from a war that we don't know about. We don't even know where Vietnam is on the map. Then they realize, oh, it's because the French asked the British, please look after our Indochina territories. After World War II, the French thought that they could subdue or suppress independence developments there in Indochina, which is Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And when the French withdrew out of that area, the Americans decided to get involved in South China because the Americans were trying to fight a war of ideology against the Soviets who were in North Vietnam. And you had the democratic South Vietnam. But their historians...
Wait, they had the same thing with North and South Korea.
Technically. It was literally two wars. There were literally two wars, Helmut, where communism and the supposed Western forces met to try and intervene or stop each other. Like in a grand scheme of chess or a grand game of chess. So South Korea, the Korean Peninsula was the first chapter, basically. It actually would have been between China and Japan. Do you know why? Because when the Americans had invaded Japan just after the Second World War, there was a Japanese Communist Party starting to emerge there in the late 40s. And the Americans were like, and then the Americans discovered that China was going to become communist between the civil war between Chiang Kai-shek and what's the guy's name?
So you're now looking at a Taiwan discussion.
Yeah, and then Chiang Kai-shek ran to Taiwan after being defeated in the last big battle, and then the Americans saw, oh my goodness, China is now fully communist. And then the discussion from there went on. The obvious assumption that the Americans made and that the French and the British saw, because the British are in India. India borders onto China. And the French are literally in what we now know is Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And the French can see, oh my goodness, communism is just here across the border from us, where we are supposed to be. And then remember, the French had asked the British, please come and patrol here. Because they had to go and fight the Second World War and situations. So there were British soldiers in French Indochina, and the British were like, it's here, communism is just here. And obviously it's a hop, skip, and a jump if you go through Indonesia and Malaysia and Singapore. No, not Singapore. Yeah, and no, there's another country. And Thailand and Philippines, then you're in Australia. It's literally, you can count. If you look at the map, I mean, you can count like five islands. Then you're in Vietnam in a straight line. So, obviously, the climate late 40s and 50s was one where the people were, people from the West were afraid of communism. Yes, there was a lot of propaganda. You know, obviously warmongering propaganda.
Yeah.
Vilifying communism in a sense of saying, yeah, it's devil's work. It's things from Satan. You know, they would show all those particular things.
So religion always pops up.
It always pops up. Do you know why?
Why?
Because under communism, you're not supposed to have freedom of expression. Under communism, you're not supposed to have the right to free speech. Under communism, you're not supposed to have religion. Religion contradicts the authority of government. Under communism, you can't have private property. Under communism, do you see all these particular things that start negating things, Helmut? And these are known examples. This is not Dwight thumb-sucking things, because if you actually go and think about it, what has existed, you go and understand, okay, people want privacy. People want their own property. You want to own something. Because if you're going to have kids, you want your kids to inherit what you have accumulated as property. But now to say I have access to something, I'm having kids, but the moment I pass away, that 99-year lease for this piece of land or this property is immediately rescinded or revoked from me because I passed away, and now my children or family are homeless or they're out on the street.
You know, two things. One of the most, I think, demoralizing when it comes to US soldiers in Vietnam was the lady, a radio personality by the name of Hanoi Hana.
I read about it.
That lady was savage.
So, yeah, but that was, look, but that was war propaganda. There's a difference between propaganda and war propaganda, because it started in the Second World War. The Germans did it to the Allied forces.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets did it to the Germans. The Germans did it to the Soviets.
The Vietnamese did it to the Americans. But look, that lady was just telling them the truth. You know, imagine you are in the heat of battle.
Mm.
And you were just listening to a giant speaker that's telling you, your wife right now, while you are dying here, is busy with another guy.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry for loving this.
How am I supposed to focus? You are going to die here, G.I.
No, but...
You're going to die here and your wife will marry someone else. Throw the gun and go back home.
But it also happened, Hamoud, in that scenario that what they discovered, when there was some, the one encyclopedia that we've got at home, it's the Encyclopedia Americana, and it literally looked at why did the Americans lose in Vietnam. Now, for us who are from the non-aligned countries, meaning, which is the actual word for the third world, that was the actual term, because we were this third force of countries that didn't want to participate in East versus West wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then we got called the third world, and the third world later on got connected to a derogatory connotation, like underdeveloped, poorly.
Became moved from political to economical.
Yeah. So it became a slur. And it's still being used. Oh, on the internet, Helmut. Some of these internet influencers, they use the word third world, and it's in a derogatory term. Now, obviously, and you don't have to guess very far from which country they come from. But when you look at what emerged in the discussion from the non-aligned countries, was the non-aligned countries were like, but you guys are the ones that have issues with each other that stems from the Second World War.
Yeah, well, just sort it out and leave us the heck out of it.
Yeah, and the biggest issue was that most of us were colonized by one of the participating nations, the UK.
But look. Was that last year in January, London, the future of energy security discussion?
Mm.
One thing that was pointed out by...
Was the IEA
event. One thing that was pointed out was... energy is needed for industrialization.
Yeah.
You need a lot of it if you want to industrialize your country. That means you need a lot of infrastructure that this energy will be based on.
Mm.
And that infrastructure doesn't come cheap. It's going to come really expensive. That means, the good thing is there are a lot of people out there that are looking for investment ventures, and they have a lot of money.
Mm.
They just want investment ventures to put their money in. And right now, one of those trending energy, you know, investment ventures is energy.
Mm.
So they're willing to put their money in there, but you really have to provide a lot of assurance. One of them is one, political stability; two, the right legislations. One, political stability is important because no one wants to invest billions and then run away the next day because the country's up in flames. That's because also these investments take very long for them to start providing return.
Yeah.
So that means you need to provide an extended, you really need to provide a very convincing political stability of once you basically proving that, you know what, once if you put this environment is safe for you to put billions of your money because it's not going to go up in flames anytime soon because we have this smooth transition of power. We have this record. Like Namibia, that's one of those things that will basically run around the world rubbing in, in everyone's face. We have had this smooth transition of power, from one leader to another. We do have disputes, but, they all go up to the, Supreme Court or where they are settled.
Yeah.
So in other words, we have disputes just like others. Take the previous elections, for example. There was Namibia's presidential elections. So basically, both the presidential and national assembly elections ended up, the national assembly elections ended up in the electoral court, but the presidential election, dispute, went to the Supreme Court because of the whole mandate discussion.
Mm. Plus, it had to wait on the
The National Assembly one
to be sorted before they could decide on the presidential one.
And actually, it's the other way around. The presidential one was the one that had actually had to
was
be decided first.
One?
Yeah. Had to be decided first. So the electoral guys had to wait.
Yeah.
Mozambique was like, you know what? Forget the courts,
let's go chitty chitty bang bang.
Yep. And now the thing is,
let's go chitty chitty.
Mozambique is like, what courts are you talking about? We don't waste time here.
Yeah. I mean, they were like, let's just join the, what do they call that thing? The everybody's got a gun club, you know? How about that?
Let's take a break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. We have 10 minutes left to the hour of 6, but before we continue, let's take a live read. This Easter, ShopRite offers a great savings on package deals such as any 4-nor soup for only 22 Namibian dollars, 2 packets of a Gold Star instant yeast for 9 Namibian dollars, 4 packets of 8 Keres sanitary pads for 24 Namibian dollars, and any 2 Nivea body lotions or cream for just 100 Namibian dollars. Don't dance with death this Easter season. A message from a company that cares, ShopRite Checkers.
Yeah, Helmut, I realize now that specifically that phrase I just used, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, was a book written by Ian Fleming, the guy that wrote 007, James Bond. And it was a children's book. It was referring to a magical flying and amphibious motor car of the 1964 book, children's book, written by Ian Fleming in the 1968 musical film for its ability. It's the car's ability to transform and its signature engine sound. I think I know now where the Transformers come from. They literally come from this particular book. So, if you guys thought I was saying anything crude, don't worry, I wasn't. It's literally a book's name. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Mozambique.
That's apparently how the car would start up. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Who the heck came up with that? No. So the next, the next 8 minutes, wrap up time. Nine to 10 years before Namibia's oil and gas industry sees production phase.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, that means you have obviously there's a lot of things that has to be in place.
Yeah.
And the unfortunately for us, we're at that time where we could really use production phase because of the whole fuel prices, but give it another 10 years, unfortunately. Now, the energy mix discussion is the only thing, I think, on a global stage, both on a national and global stage, that is sort of like allowing, you know, discussions like this to take place. And also, the wide industrial application of the oil and gas, both direct and indirect, like the byproducts that's coming out of it. Because you need them for your plastic, for roads, for fuel and everything. So, and also you have a lot of companies, companies obviously a part of that discussion, and countries that are still heavily reliant on oil and gas for revenues. And unfortunately, most of them are up in flames right now.
Yeah.
Look, all you can say is Russia is going to have a good time for a while. Because it's very easy to blow up a piece of infrastructure like a petroleum refinery, but rebuilding it from the ground up, that takes forever.
Yeah.
That takes a very long time. Obviously it's much easier to, you know, it's much easier to repair something than to build it from the ground up. But, the thing is, until the atmosphere settles, which looks like it's not gonna happen anytime soon, things, I think it's safe to say, it's, you know, are gonna get worse before they get better. But, the good thing is, we don't have to worry about, you know, Namibia's oil and gas infrastructure being blown up because it's still non-existent. It's still in the blueprint, as you can imagine. When it starts, you want it to have the right, you want it to be run around the right policies.
Definitely, Hamud. And also, just before I take a quick live read, the other important thing is also, there's this particular lack of bringing forward discussions around, are we going to update our legislation, specifically like legislation around the Minerals Act and also the Petroleum Act. The Petroleum Act is obviously getting that one change.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously also about other particular energy sources that would pop up, like nuclear, like green hydrogen. Hamud, 2 weeks from now, actually a week and a couple of days from today, I'll be going to a specific event here in Namibia where the green hydrogen will take the next phase. It'll get into the next particular phase. And it's not an MOU signing that is being highlighted in the invitation. It's literally an agreement, a supply agreement. Now, supply agreement, Hamid, needs to tell you already, okay, so things are kicking off. So when we look at things here, the discussion being about, and this is what I said back in one of the shows we did back in 2024, when we spoke about green hydrogen specifically, is that you can actually see which one of the two energy sources, put the green ammonia to one side, because we know that green ammonia now is being touted to become, to boost fertilizer production, which is meant for agriculture. If you look at the actual hydrogen source for energy, the hydrogen investments in Namibia will happen before and have been happening before final investment decisions are being made for oil and gas. Whose final investment decision? Shell on their particular oil exploration activity in the same vicinity as Total? Or is it Total? Or is it Galp, the Portuguese guys? Or is it Chevron, the Americans? Who and which particular exploration block? So the conversation is also one of, because people keep mentioning the final investment decision. Whose final investment decision are we talking about? Let's be specific. Because Total's people are the only one that has so far come forward and have presented and have had stakeholder engagements. But where's Shell's people? Why haven't they come forward with their stakeholder engagements and public participation scenarios?
Give them 10 years, dude. They're going to come around.
Where's Galp's people? Why haven't Galp's people come forward with public engagement and stakeholder engagements in Namibia? you have to go to their website. You, if Google doesn't pull it up for you as an indicator. Yeah. But yeah. But before we continue, guys, we're going to take a short break. Bavitsi University, for the 2026 July applications that are now open for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Level 8. The following admission requirements indicate that the candidates should have a recognized nursing qualification and at NQF Level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institution, must be a registered nurse or midwife with the Nursing Council of Namibia or the HPCNA, must have a minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse or midwife in any health facility, must be able to write a short essay describing the motivation for pursuing a postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification duration is 1 year. Mode of delivery will be full-time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406, Velvice University, where everyone is an achiever. Yeah, so final investment decisions, Helmut. I don't know.
First of all,
apparently it's supposed to happen later in this year.
I am not sure.
Not sure. Because when you and I did the gas to power discussion, what was the one thing that we realized when we presented that talk here on the Home Run? The actual decision for the gas to power discussion to become operational was pushed into this year because no, it was supposed to happen last year. It never came through. A whole year later, how much?
It's the rail discussion one.
No, not the rail. Gas to power. From the Kudu gas field.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the energy company that apparently, has the particular sort of like contract to, start and to make the project commercialize the project?
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
A minute past the hour of 6, so that obviously brings us to the end of Home Run for today. But the question here obviously remains is, are we going to have the right legislations in place come 2035? Mm. Yeah, by 2035 when production phase is reached in the oil and gas industry. Are we going to have the right legislations that will ensure that Namibia actually joins the statistics of countries that have success stories that are not full of tears with regards to the resources they have discovered?
Success
stories. Yeah. Because you have to understand, it wasn't, I didn't actually know it until you pointed out that the Norwegians had a little bit of tears before they quickly learned. unlike the Dutch.
About like 20 years at least.
Yeah, unlike the Dutch who only found out when it was, the resource was, you know, was already out that, oh boy, what have we done?
Yeah.
So the Norwegian was quick to, you know, it took about 20 years?
Yeah, the Norwegians, because for them, they, their gas and oil started flowing from the 70s. But from the 70s, the discussion was one of, because you obviously know that Norway is not part of OPEC.
Yeah.
But if you're part of OPEC, things look weird because now suddenly either you get invaded like Syria, no, not like Syria, like Iraq, or you get destabilized like Syria, or you get completely busted up into two parts like Libya, which were all OPEC members.
Yeah.
Or the question starts popping up in terms of, okay, do you have to go yourself like a Norway? Do you have to operate differently like a country like Malaysia? No, but Malaysia is also part of OPEC, I think. Or are you going to be a are you going to be someone like Scotland? Because Scotland has the oil and gas fields right off the, right in the North Sea specifically. Mm-hmm. So between Iceland and Europe, there's this North Sea oil and gas field that the Scottish through the UK government are operating.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? They closed off their own petrochemicals plant, which created thousands of jobs in the UK. Produced a
is
lot
that
of
part of their energy transition agenda.
Suppose that's the same thing that the Germans was also did. Remember the story about the nuclear power stations?
Mm-hmm.
They decided to go switch them off, but they switch on the coal.
They started
switching on the coal power station. I'm like, what are you doing? The one is greener than the other one. Who switches off the nuclear power station?
That coming from the Germans, I went like, guys.
Seriously.
Okay. Now.
Seriously. I mean, like, in epic levels, I'm like, it's here.
Who's making these decisions?
It's here.
Yeah, 4 minutes in the hour of six. That brings us to the end of Home Run for today. So we still have 10 years to go, guys. For the oil and gas production phase to be reached. And 2030, I wouldn't put my money on 2030. I wouldn't put my money on 2030. And that's based on the industry baseline survey that was done in 2024. That puts the production phase somewhere 2033, 2035, somewhere there, not 2030.
Yeah.
So with that, until tomorrow, same time, same place on your favorite radio station, Eagle FM. From me, you all have a blessed evening.
And from my side, dear listeners, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company. Stay tuned for the BS discussion right after this break.
That'll be Business with Roy.
It's the least BS, Amor, because it's business.
It's BWR. On that note, guys,
see you tomorrow.